You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the US has been spying on the French president, quelle surprise, and not just the current one. But is François Hollande's outrage justified? Do the French intelligence services themselves have anything to declare? My guests Xenia Wickett and James Schneider will be here to talk all about it. Then, as the Confederate flag is taken down from public spaces across the US, we'll ask whether celebrating the past is of any use to the present and its present-day problems. We'll also discuss Hong Kong, where the Occupy Central movement has been finally moved on for the last time. What did it achieve, and what is the natural lifespan of a protest? All that plus a look at Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's tough new line on Europe, rather than the migrants flocking to it. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, Project Director of the US programme at Chatham House, and James Schneider, Editorial Director at New African Magazine. Xenia and James, welcome to you both. We begin with France and new revelations claiming that the US intelligence services have been spying on French President François Hollande and his two predecessors, Nicolas Sarkozy and Jacques Chirac. Naturally, Hollande is outraged, he says, about his personal phone calls and emails being spied upon, and has summoned the US ambassador to explain. Last time this kind of story emerged with German Chancellor Angela Merkel as the victim of US snooping, it later turned out that German intelligence services had been playing the exact same game with regard to other governments. Xenia Wickett, democracies spy on each other, don't they? We should stop being surprised by this.
Yes. I mean, sorry, but just get over yourself. This is the reality. This is what we do. We're all trying to understand, and not necessarily for negative reasons. You know, we all are actually trying to find the best solution to problems, trying to understand where other people are coming from, try and improve transparency, try and improve understanding. It happens that spying can be an effective way of doing that. We don't like it. It seems awfully dirty to us, and yet we do it to one another all the time. We just need to get over this and recognize it's happening. On the other hand, politically, of course, that's unpalatable. And so we do what's expedient, which is politically we say, this is awful, this is shocking, I'm going to call the ambassador in. And you demarsh one another, you say nasty words to one another, and then you get on with the job.
James Schneider, it would have been interesting if François Hollande had said, I'm not surprised by this. We do it to the Americans as well. Do you want to know what Joe Biden had for breakfast?
Actually, what I'm surprised, sorry, I'm going to interrupt James for a second. What I'm surprised is why he didn't say, give up the goss on Sarkozy.
Well, there is that as well.
Well, they've given out a little bit of the goss on Sarkozy, the little snippets of the stories, and basically all that's come out is he was quite a megalomaniac, which isn't really that surprising. He was going to solve the Eurozone crisis, he was going to solve the financial crisis, and he was going to solve Israel-Palestine. So these are things we probably already assumed. But to your question, I think they're allowed to reserve the right to basically drag whoever it is over the coals for a bit for some kind of diplomatic gain. They've had a diplomatic loss by having some of their private conversations overheard on, and they're allowed to sort of have a bit of a go, even though it's a false game on both sides.
And there's a difference, James, that, we should, I think it's important for us to distinguish between a democratic government spying on another democratic government and some of the other things in the Edward Snowden revelations of a democratic government spying on citizens.
Yeah, exactly. So the problem isn't really that someone knows what the French cabinet are thinking about questions of policy. In some ways, those are things that more people should know about. But yeah, exactly as you say, it's when the state has overbearing power over its citizens and it can warp and change lives, potentially, in ways that are totally outside and are totally unreasonable or disproportionate, then that's where there's a problem. So I think the point of this oh God, this isn't this so terrible about the French? It's not really because we care so much about Jacques Chirac being overheard on, but it's about the relationship between the individual and the state.
Zania, I'm interested in what happens next here, because the formulation of the US comment, a spokesman saying, was the US is not targeting and will not target the communications of Monsieur Hollande. It doesn't obviously deal with what might have happened in the past, but that's quite a firm comment on what is going to happen in the future. And there was a very similar formulation with regarding Angela Merkel as well. Do you think that actually the US is going to do what it's done there and will actually think, okay, well, maybe the leaders are off limits now? And if so, what impact does that have?
Certainly for a while. That will certainly happen for a while. The interesting thing to ask yourself is how much benefits, you know, in terms of the information that they got from listening to Sarkozy or Chirac or Hollande or Merkel, what was the benefit versus what has been the cost in terms of German and French populations' attitudes towards the United States, in terms of the diplomat, you know, the kind of what will be a very brief diplomatic, you know, freezing, if you will. And my guess is that for allies like the Germans, the French, the Brits, Americans and vice versa will say, you know what, the information we're getting actually isn't enough to warrant the cost of actually listening into this. And they'll stop doing it. That will be different as also, I mean, you emphasize the difference between listening to allied leaders and listening to citizens. It'll be different listening to allied leaders versus listening to, say, Putin.
Yes, obviously, James Schneider, the US is not going to stop trying to listen to someone like Vladimir Putin. Do you think that, you know, maybe the US and others will think, as Zanya says, is there really, do we really get much out of this now? Well, should we look, you know, divert our resources elsewhere?
Well, do they get more than they would get from the slightly gossipy end of even stuff that's sort of public domain journalism, let alone just talking? You know, you can go and talk to somebody, oh, you know, so-and-so's a cabinet minister, he's a friend, you'll say off the record this, that and the other. You basically know what happened in every cabinet meeting, if anyone wants to know. And they already do know without having to spy so totally directly, at least the, not even the vague contours, pretty much the whole outline of what is being spoken about. Like, it's not like the America would have not known what Hollande's view on Grexit was without having, you know, a bug in the room to hear the exact words he's saying. So I think in these cases, it's not really necessary.
Yeah, I mean, when I worked in government, in the US government, both at the State Department and the White House, I mean, that's why you have various layers. Well, it's not why you have, but one of the functions of various layers of diplomacy is to make sure they have good relations with their colleagues in other governments, so that actually behind every senior level conversation is a multitude of lower level conversations that are understanding the nuances, understanding the various different opinions of other people. You know, as the Americans have found to their detriment, it is actually very, very hard to keep things quiet. You know, you look at all of the WikiLeaks and other leaks that have come out of the US over the last, say, decade. It's very, very hard to keep things quiet. It just doesn't happen.
We're going to stick with the United States and a different story, the Confederate flag and its connotations with the era of slavery in the US South continues to ignite debate in the wake of the racist mass shooting in Charleston. The flag is being removed from many locations, not just in the public spaces in the South where it can often be seen, but now online retailers such as Amazon, Google, even China's Alibaba have announced the removal of ads promoting products featuring the image. James Schneider, it seems that something has changed with this over the last 3 or 4 days, that those that would try and claim before, oh, well, this is part of our heritage and it's very important that outsiders understand this and don't try and mess with it, that attitude seems to have dissipated somewhat.
And I think it's one of the big driving forces of that was the choreographed, almost sort of artistic photographs of hatred that Dylan Roof took and those coming out into the press. I think where you could see how firmly these symbols played in the mind of a racist terrorist, it became untenable, unless you're Bill O'Reilly, to say that this flag has to, I mean, he has said that it's a mark of bravery or whatever. And also it was quite good to see actually how some Republican politicians were incredibly quick off the mark. So of course, like, Hillary Clinton has opposed it, blah blah blah, but the first one at least that I noticed was Mitt Romney almost immediately on Twitter put that out. And I think that sort of, you know, set the frame for what is acceptable for what then other Republican politicians can do. And interestingly, in the South Carolina, their legislature, they're now trying to get it taken down. And it was Republicans who were the first ones, I think, to...
It was a Republican governor.
It was a Republican governor, but before that, it was the legislators who put... Because one of the people who was killed was a state legislator, and they put forward the proposal that had to come down. So I think these early actions plus the images have made that much more possible.
Though, having said that, Zenuwick, it was a little bit different for the Republican presidential candidates, many of whom said things like, well, this is an issue for the state, or the bodies haven't been buried yet, so we really shouldn't talk about this yet. Race is still a big issue for the Republican Party to deal with.
Race is very definitely a big issue for the Republican Party to deal with, and quite possibly it will be the defining issue of who ends up being the who can get the Hispanic vote will play a huge role in who gets the presidency in 2016. But what I think is really interesting from this story is the ability of an actor to use a window of opportunity. Timing being so important. I mean, this idea of the Confederate flag has been bubbling along. The desire by a number of people to get rid of the Confederate flag has been bubbling along for years now. I think it's the Texas legislator who recently just kind of announced and got through the Supreme, and the Supreme Court agreed with them that they didn't have to produce flags on number plates, that the individual couldn't ask for things like this. So, I mean, this is an issue that's been around, but really hasn't risen to a high level where it's got the kind of public attention. And, you know, whether it's one person or some people or whether it's social media, but, you know, this, people have fixated on this, and over the last week, you're suddenly seeing a huge change. And so the question that I start asking is, okay, so what is clear is the Confederate flag is a no-no today. What about gun control? You know, are there small steps? And you can see that President Obama was trying to
He's taken every small step he's allowed to within his powers.
And you're just wondering, what is going to be the marker that actually suddenly go, okay, the world has changed, we need to change with it. We suddenly have to have a real swing in public opinion and political opinion on an issue.
That's an interesting... I was actually going to broaden out in a different way, but let's actually stick on that, because, James, that's the thing. We talk about a symbol here. We talk about taking down a flag. No one, and that's become the thing. No one is talking about gun control.
Well,
when I say no one, that's not on the agenda. That's not the thing that...
Okay, so Obama in that interview with the, the WTF podcast, I think, where he uses the N-word, when he speaks about gun control, he says, you know, something needs to happen. It needs to happen from citizens. We can't do it with this Congress unless there is this massive change. He has spoken about that. But then he also spoke about, and some of the better people speaking about this issue have made the point that, yes, this is a symbol, but it's a symbol of a structure of racism which continues in a whole series of ways in the US. And it's how that a political movement can be built off the back of this that moves it forward in some way. So one suggestion was improving voting rights, so pulling back a lot of the ways that lots of black voters have been disenfranchised, and using this as a jumping point off to do something like that. But yeah, that's what has to happen.
James, I want to touch on something that happened in South Africa earlier this year, where there was a statue of Cecil Rhodes at the University of Cape Town, and there was a protest based on someone threw feces over that statue. It seemed at the time quite random, but that grew into a process of people saying, hang on, why is Cecil Rhodes, this symbol of, you know, white colonial imperialism, staring down at us as we go every day to study at university? And there was this campaign called Rhodes Must Fall, which eventually led to this statue being taken down. And when you look at what's happening with the Confederate flag and then with this statue here, it's interesting that it just needs one tiny spark, whatever that is, or in the case of obviously the Confederate flag, a horrendous attack, to make people think about the symbols that we have around us all over the world, which we just walk past or ignore a lot of the time.
And I think, well, in the South African case, there was this discourse going on, there was this conversation, there is this quite vibrant conversation going on, especially in universities, about what South African identity means and how to deal with the colonial and apartheid and racist history. And this built on that this was emblematic of those conversations and of that rage. But yes, it's weird as soon as you start to look around. So, for example, there's Jan Smuts in Parliament Square, which I never really noticed, but I was there the other day and I walked past and went, oh, that's rather peculiar. Jan Smuts is there. And these little things do make you look at the world around you and then think, well, what's going on?
Zainia, how far should this be taken? Because we could walk down now to Parliament Square and go past Whitehall, and I'm fairly sure that between the three of us, we could point out the odd character here or there who had some pretty dodgy views and was responsible for some pretty horrendous acts. Do you think that's, should there be an audit of statues to see actually, are we sort of still fating the wrong people?
Not if you believe in small government, no. And I mean, I think what really I take away from this is this idea that times change. You know, somebody who was a hero in one era can become something entirely different in another. And one of the challenges that we face is trying to understand things in context and perhaps choosing to make some things symbols, but equally choosing not to make other things symbols, to not choose to see the negative consequences of some actions and actually say that one will lie and we'll move on. And I think that to me is what's so interesting about this.
But it's easier to let something lie if it's actually not something that you feel affects you.
I think at some level, this is the problem that Jan Smuts is going to, the Confederate flag is something that for many people is a part of their heritage. You know, it is something that is indicative of history. The trouble is that for the vast majority, it also indicates something that is actually, in today's world, is abhorrent. But 70 or 80 years ago, it was the norm.
Yeah, so half my family are from the American South, and some of them maybe at some times might have thought that, yeah, that's an important part of their identity, so on and so forth, and you should
times
be respectful
change.
Of that. But when a constituent part of your identity is based on the oppression of other people, you have to change your identity, and there comes a certain point at which that has to go. And so, they, regardless of how historically important it is to them, they need to drop it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we'll end on that note of agreement. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. James Schneider and Zainia Wickett are with me. I'll be back in a moment.
It's big, handsome, and we'll spend the whole summer by your side. It's the sun-dappled July-August Quality of Life double issue, and it's waiting for you now. Here's what our editors have lined up.
In culture, we look at media at the heart of the city, visiting those cool cats at New York Magazine, Cadena Ser in Madrid, and Radio Liban in Beirut.
In the design section, we meet the Swedish firm excelling in the growing world of wooden high-rises.
In the edit section, we meet three startups improving city living in Oslo, Paris, and Hong Kong.
The July-August issue is on sale now, or make your life easier with a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the club.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Zainia Wickett and James Schneider. Today, the last two protesters camped out near government headquarters in Hong Kong were removed after 270 days of demonstrations at the same site. They were part of the Occupy Central movement, which appeared in September last year, asking for more democratic rights for Hong Kong from mainland China. We didn't succeed, but we also didn't fail, said 71-year-old Simon Wong, one of the last protesters at the site. James Schneider, you know, this was a protest that really caught the imagination back in September and in October and for a period after that, and drew huge attention to issues over democracy in Hong Kong. But then it's sort of dissipated. And frankly, if I hadn't just told you that it ended today and the last two people had been taken away, you know, none of us in this room would really be aware of where it is. Is this essentially a problem with protests when they are not, when there's not one clearly defined thing that they are for?
No.
Or one achievable goal that they're for? They kind of peter out disappointingly.
It depends on your perspective. I mean, protests, I mean, let's take this particular protest. It's doing two things. It has some short-term immediate goals and it has some more medium-term goals and perhaps long, but we'll forget the long-term goals for the minute. The short-term goals, they were trying to prevent China selecting, Beijing selecting the candidates that they would get to choose from in their elections. Okay, so they didn't get that. So they had the big protest, they captured a lot of imagination, blah, blah, blah. Beijing held firm, they didn't win. So if you only look at that, then it peters out and it looks a bit sad and a bit disappointing. But if you take perhaps a more sort of medium-term view, well, if they didn't protest against it, well, that might have been the first thing that Beijing did, was say, right, well, we said we would give you these democratic freedoms. Well, we're going to give you them, but on our own terms. And then, you know, the next time there may be fewer, and the next time there may be fewer. And it was a statement, very clear statement from a broad section of our Hong Kongese society that they couldn't push them past a certain point and they had popular pressure. So even though for the actual activists themselves, the last two guys, it might be a bit sad, but the person who's quoted, that sort of 71-year-old person, when he says, you know, we won and we lost, he's right. They did. They lost in their immediate, clear attempt to get they have the free reign of candidates, but they might have won perhaps a more important battle, but it's just less apparent.
And Zanya, when we look back at protests from the past, and, you know, some are successful and some aren't in terms of, you know, their actual goals, but they tended to be more, you know, a single demonstration, whether it was the Million Man March in Washington or more recently here, the million or so people who marched against the war in Iraq, which obviously in some ways failed because the war went ahead, but certainly, you know, underscored the depth of feeling there was amongst a large number of people in the country. Is that sort of protest a lot easier to be like, right, we've done our thing and we've made a point?
Well, I think, I mean, you have to remember there was the world has changed. So today the protests are taking place not just in person sitting in Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Central in the case of Hong Kong, but, you know, protests are taking place on online, social media. You know, just go back to the protests against, I'm totally forgetting the catchphrase, but against, we were talking about Boko Haram earlier.
Bring back our girls.
Bring back our girls. You know, again, did that succeed? Did it not succeed? It certainly raised awareness. The Kony video that went viral, what, 2-3 years ago now, date back 15, 20 years ago, kind of protest on mine action, where the NGOs managed to force governments into taking a totally new approach to the use of mines. So, you know, the idea that civil society, if you will, can actually change policy is a very powerful one and has been present throughout history. What's happening today is that, as often as not, those protests aren't taking place in reality, but they're taking place on social media. So many more formats by which we can actually express our angst and our anger and often effect change, albeit not the one critical action that we were trying to do, but more broadly change the debate, change the conversation for a future generation, perhaps.
Is one of the issues here, James, the fact that so many of these protests now are quite democratic in how they make their decisions, how they spring up. There's no leadership to say, right, we are organising this march on this date, let's go. Or we are going to take this sort of action, we're going to lobby our politicians on this day. And so it means that they then become quite hard to control, either the message or the medium.
No, I don't think that's the case. If you look at, if we take Occupy Wall Street or Occupy London or the Direct Action Network for Global Justice in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were perfectly capable of organising very strong messages that we all know about. They had to be removed by state force. And they were able to take decisions. They were able to say what they were about. Now, they didn't elect themselves a leader and say, we have a minimalist program, which are these three things. But also, that wasn't necessarily what they're about. They wouldn't have just gone home if they got, you know, a slightly larger banks levy, for example, because what they're about was something quite more fundamental.
The other thing about such structures where you don't have a leader, yes, I believe I'm with you, Steve, there is a cost to that in terms of actually being able to define very, very clearly what you want to achieve, which of course assumes you've actually got somebody you're negotiating with who is willing to listen. There's a benefit too, which is it's very, very hard to shut them down. If you don't have a leader, if you've got people engaging through social media about when the next demonstration is going to be, et cetera, very, very hard to shut down. And you're seeing that not just in democracies like the UK and the US, but you're seeing that in China.
And one final quick
go on.
I think we have to see protest and social movements in a much longer historical duration and not necessarily about the characters that emerge in leadership for a short period of time, because if we look at, you know, like the canonical history for the development of the welfare state in Britain, let's say, that's like a 100-year process of organising and all the rest of it. And there were many failures, and if you take short-term perspectives, it looked like there were lots of failures, but overall, quite a big victory.
Before we end, I want to turn briefly to Italy. The country's Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, has written a heartfelt piece in a UK newspaper addressing the future of the migrant crisis currently consuming the Mediterranean. In it, Renzi makes the point that this crisis is not Italy's solely to deal with, it is Europe's. And I think it's worth just quoting a little bit from it. He is saying that today's problem isn't about Italy facing this emergency alone. We're a great country that will not fall into hysteria just because one year we have a few thousand more refugees than expected. If forced to do it alone, we would not shy away from the challenge. We will not stop saving lives because on our shoulders we have centuries of civilizations. We will not turn our backs on that just to improve our ratings in the opinion polls. Human life matters more than approval. James Schneider, these are sort of words we haven't really heard so far from European leaders.
It's powerful stuff. It's very good rhetoric. I think it's clear that it's coming from the person who actually stands most to gain from it. I mean, I think that would be substantially more powerful if David Cameron or some other leader for who they don't get the migrants coming in from the Mediterranean said, it is part of our civilization to not let people drown and blah, 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 which is why we're going to stand with Italy and with the migrants. Then I think that would be an honest statement of those things. I'm still pleased it's happened, but he does benefit.
He does, Zenia, but it's interesting when he talks about, for his generation, Europe's identity begins with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and he doesn't want for his children a new wall to come up separating Europe from the rest of the world.
So, I mean, I'm with James. I mean, he makes a really good, strong point. I mean, he says at one point, responsibility and solidarity are concepts that go hand in hand. He talks about the values of the European Union, of Europe, and how important they are. You know, and you can talk about many of the same things he's talking about in the sense of, you know, are we going to let Greece exit? I think there is a kind of zeitgeist. There's an angst in Europe today about what it is we stand for, and are we going to stay together, or are we going to dissipate? And I think he is tapping into that on the migrants issue. Whether it's going to have any impact or not is a different question entirely.
And James, you know, as you say, it is one thing for Matteo Renzi to say that Northern European and further Western European leaders have been more reticent. Do you detect any softening? Do you think that this sort of approach from Mr. Renzi helps to persuade any other leaders?
It's better than nothing. It needs to be tried. There's no softening of the stance. The stance continues to be completely disgraceful, and the smokescreen of the military attempts to attack the smugglers, I think that's what's going to be used. That's what we're going to hear a lot about, which is not going to deal with the issue in any way.
One thing to add, what I think is really, really interesting, is he's doing almost what Putin did a year or so ago. He's actually appealing to the people. What he's recognised is the governments aren't going to change unless the publics change. So he has to appeal to the people.
And Tsipras is doing the same.
And Tsipras is doing exactly the same.
We'll leave it there. Xenia Wickett and James Schneider, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. Midori House was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Elena Nikolacheva and Tamor Hoveda Williams. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Josh Fennett will be with you next. The Entrepreneurs is then up at 1900 hours. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.